Blog Talk Radio.
Oh, the shark bait has such teeth there, and it shows them pearly white. Just a...
Good afternoon, everybody. This is your host of the Milwaukee Mab, Wayne Klugman. I want everybody here, please, sound in my voice, please stand, as we welcome, I'm going to really mispronounce this poor man's name, Steve Stringola, the man I have to call the Bat Masterson of crime fighting in southeastern Wisconsin. A longtime Milwaukee serving detective, now retired, works on television and educating people around this country. Let's have a warm welcome and cheer for this fine, great guy. Hey, go you, sir.
Hey, Mr. Klingman, thanks for the nice introduction. How are you?
I'm cold, sir. I'm cold.
Yeah, it is cold here in Wisconsin.
Yes, it is. But without debating the weather too much, because there's not much to do about that, how do you get your start in law enforcement, sir?
I was interested in law enforcement in high school. I started out as what was called a police aide with the Milwaukee Police Department, where I went to school half a day. And then I did clerical work for the police department. And then at the age of 21, I was promoted to police officer, and I worked 30 years in the city of Milwaukee, and I retired in 2006 as a lieutenant.
Wow. You've seen a lot.
It has. You know, Milwaukee's changed, and like any big city, it goes through different spurts, growth spurts, and now, unfortunately, violent crime spurts.
Well, absolutely. I mean, I remember the 80s, especially down Racine, was one where it seemed every day that we had a new shooting. Thankfully, the Milwaukee seems to have gone up, but Racine's come down. I hope that the reduction in crime still goes on. But in your years in law enforcement, you've dealt with some very interesting cases. Have you not, sir?
Well, I have a lot of them. I think actually every case is interesting. Some just have... I guess a little bit more media attention to it that attracts people to some of that.
That's true. I mean, I have to say that we all know the big one that you were involved in, the Jeffrey Dahmer situation. And I know there's a lot of media about that, a lot of badly done TV movies and the like about that versus what happened in real life. Do you mind if we discuss that case for a few minutes, sir?
No, go ahead. Go ahead.
We all know that. Correct me if I'm wrong, because I'm sure I don't have the facts right, because I get most of my stuff, as most Americans did at the time, from television news and, again, the poorly done movies. Mr. Dahmer found different gay men and killed them in his apartment building, cannibalized some of them for years. How much of that is true and how much of that is false?
Well, that's pretty accurate. You know, there's been a lot of books, a lot of media attention around Jeffrey Dahmer. And it was back in July 1991 that he was arrested. And he probably had been killing people for about a year and a half in the city of Milwaukee, predominantly gay males that he picked up in the Third Ward area, which is an area near the Summerfest grounds. But it's predominantly caverns where gay men would... gather, and that's where Dahmer would go to, fish for his victims, and wound up taking him back to his apartment and killing him, and then killing them and cutting up the bodies.
Incredible. How many victims he had in the Milwaukee area, sir?
There were 15 in the Milwaukee area, and there was one in Bath Township, Ohio. That was a kid he killed first. That was a white kid, and the rest of the people that he killed were either African-American or Hispanic up in the Milwaukee area.
Wow. It's the thing that he was able to murder 15 people in the course of a little over a year and a half. Do you understand that correctly, sir?
That's true. Yeah, he was pretty. He was actually pretty good at what he did. There was alcohol involved. There were other drugs that were used by Dahmer, sleeping pills and ether and chloroform. But basically, he was just successful. You know, he was a good talker. He could bullshit with these people, and he got him back to his apartment. And between the alcohol and the sleeping pills, they passed out, and just basically later you know, cut up the bodies and save some of the bodies, the parts in his apartment.
Wow. So how was he finally apprehended?
There was another individual in his apartment back in July, an individual by the name of Tracy Edwards. And he had done the same thing with Tracy Edwards that he did with other victims. He brought them to the apartment, and he gave them alcohol that was basically adulterated with sleeping pills. And unfortunately for Dahmer, he didn't put enough of the sleeping pills in the alcohol, and Edwards was able to escape from the apartment. He tried to handcuff Edwards, and Edwards ran out and flagged down a squad car and informed them that he had seen a head in the refrigerator in Dahmer's apartment. And the uniformed officers went upstairs. They discovered the head, and that led to the arrest of Jeffrey Dahmer.
Thank God. Now, earlier, and this is, I know I don't have the facts here correct. I'm hoping that you can straighten out my misinformation. There was a man, a teenager, that also earlier escaped and ran and found help. But that didn't turn out so well for that young man, correct?
That's right. It was a young man named Conorak Sintasam Phone. He's a 14-year-old Asian male who Dahmer had picked up in a park near his apartment on 25th and Wells, and had taken the young man back to his apartment. And basically the same thing happened. Dahmer gave him a mixture of alcohol and sleeping pills, and he thought the kid, he had actually drilled a hole. What Dahmer would do is he, after these people passed out, is he would drill a hole in their head with just a drill, and he would dump in muriatic acid, which he said made these people like zombies. And at one point, he left the apartment that night to go get beer. And because he thought Conorak was completely disabled and unconscious. But when he came back, Conorak had walked out of the apartment and was walking down the street naked. And one of the neighbors notified the Milwaukee Police Department, and a squad was dispatched. And it subsequently was a very sad chapter in the history of the police department. They ultimately turned Conorak back over to Dahmer, who killed him about 2 hours later.
Wow. Yeah, I know that many people outside the police department, not knowing what goes on within the police department, was very, very critical of what happened and held to those officers to, I don't know, maybe a higher standard than necessary. I don't know. The questions I'm asked about this when this comes up with conversations about Dahmer is how could it possibly be happening where two policemen would turn over this young man to Dahmer again?
Well, you know, first of all, it was on a July night in 1991. It was actually in early, maybe in late June. And what happened was it was the third shift officer, so they had started at midnight. And by the time they started, they were about 80 hitches in the hole, 80 assignments in the hole. And so basically what happened is by the time they took that assignment with Conorak, the dispatcher was asking them to take other assignments where there were shots fired and people injured in the area. It was just a very busy night. And unfortunately, they didn't realize what they had there with Conorak, and they were actually bamboozled. You know, Dahmer came right up to them and said, "Hey, this is my lover. We had a fight. Can I take him back?" And the officers, they turned Conorak back over to Dahmer, thinking that they were, lovers or at least friends. And unfortunately, the worst thing that could have possibly happened did occur, and that Dahmer killed Conorak shortly thereafter.
Right, right. I think that one thing I wish I knew as a member of the civilian population, I know once in a while, living in Racine, we have to call the police occasionally, and sometimes they can take a while to show up. We get so used to thinking that we can make that phone call, they're going to be in our home instantly. And sadly, that doesn't happen much anymore, can it?
No, it doesn't. It doesn't.
Because many times the police, as you were saying yourself, could have other calls they have to get to as soon as they can, too, correct?
It's true, and they prioritize these. And, I think that it was just one of those unfortunate circumstances that night, the perfect storm between the officers and that district being overworked and, you know, Dahmer having enough courage just to walk up to these officers and say, hey, that's my lover. We just had a fight, you know, and Connor had to turn back over to him.
Oh, absolutely, yeah, these things occur. We will hope that they do not, but sadly they do. Yeah, it's just the whole thing with Dahmer and what happened, I think is so horrific that people are unable to get out of the emotional effects of that situation, in my opinion at least. I mean, I can't imagine
that's
what it would be like to be a working police officer where you don't know if it's going to have a normal day at night, little things, or are you going to see the car wreck, are you going to see the murder, are you going to see the woman half beaten to death by her boyfriend, what are you going to be running into?
That's true.
And you're also in Milwaukee. You've dealt with the, I'm just going to mispronounce that young man's name, the young man that was blown up by the bomb, but the outlaws, or more so, a gang was led to believe, planted for him, or
well,
planted for someone?
Yeah, that was back in 1994 when I was just joining the police department. My brother and I went to grade school with this kid. His name was Larry Anstep. And at the time, there was an early morning newspaper in Milwaukee called The Sentinel. And Larry Anstett was a Sentinel boy delivering the newspapers at about 6:30 in the morning in November of 1974. And he, on his paper route, there was a member of the Hell's Angels, a guy with the last name of Vermilia. And Vermilia, being the leader of the Hell's Angels, was always feuding with members of the Outlaws. And a real tragic situation occurred. One of the members of the Outlaws built a bomb and wrapped it up like a Christmas present or a birthday present and placed it on top of Vermilia's car. And as Anstett was delivering papers, he noticed this gift and picked it up. And unfortunately, it contained dynamite with a mercury switch. It detonated, and he was killed instantly by the blast.
Wow. I understand it was one of the biggest, there's wrong way to put it, one of the most powerful bombs ever planted, correct?
It was. You know, it took some sophistication. There was actually dynamite involved with it. It had a motion switch so that when it was picked up and tilted, caused the bomb to go off. Anstett was just, you know, basically shredded. Parts of his body were found like a block and a half away. He was killed instantly, but it was a very powerful bomb that did massive destruction to the house and car that was there at the time.
Incredible. Now, was the band who planted the bomb ever found?
No, there's good speculation who it is. In fact, there were other people. You know, it's an interesting story, really interesting. In fact, a graduate student has written a book about it. It details the feuding between the Hell's Angels and the Outlaws in Milwaukee, and includes a number of deaths that were related to this because there were a few witnesses and a few people who had knowledge about who planted that bomb. And subsequently, probably the best witness they had, his body was found buried in a farm in Waukesha. And there's been speculation as to who's done that. But, you know, unfortunately, the DA in Waukesha County at the time didn't want to issue charges against the individual, and to this day, there's still an ongoing investigation involved into that case.
Do you think that we'll have the opportunity to see this case brought to justice?
You know, there's a chance. There's still, you know, nowadays with some different technology, some different DNA, the question's always been, how did this body get out to this farm in Waukesha? And there were some, you know, people who were willing to testify at the time. But part of the problem was that, you know, their credibility was called into question because they were members of the Outlaws who had participated in other crimes and had been arrested a number of times. And I don't think a district attorney at the time wanted to go and issue charges based on, you know, the information that these individuals provided. Their character was called into question.
Right, yeah. Do you have the information that would convince the jury that these people aren't making it up for something that they get returned?
Right.
Absolutely. impressed with the use of different technologies. We can get more information and hopefully bring this case to a close, because that young man definitely deserves justice.
You know, he was just an innocent kid delivering newspapers before school winds up running into this, you know, this feud and suffered this violent death. And it's really an unfortunate situation.
Well, absolutely. The thing gets me is, too, as we see in TV shows such as Sons of Anarchy and other media, that motorcycle gangs are really cool things to hang out in. We can all go sit down, have a couple of beers, have a nice time, but in real life, they're very, 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 or can be very, very vicious people.
Oh, it's incredibly vicious. I mean, they're willing to go out and kill to protect their, you know, their secrets. And I mean, it's, you know, a lot of these people have been involved in violent confrontations with other gang members. I mean, you know, I think it was about 2 years ago, if you remember, down, I think it was in Texas, the Bandidos, the Hells Angels, the Outlaws, you know, they had a gun battle. And it's every once in a while you see these occur at these motorcycle bars. There was a tavern here in Milwaukee back in the early 80s, I believe it was, maybe late 70s, called the New Boot. It was actually in West Milwaukee. And a bunch of innocent people who were in a tavern got caught in the crossfire between a couple members of the Outlaws and Hells Angels, and they were killed. And, you know, like I said, these motorcycle gangs, you know, a lot of people, you know, maybe fancy themselves and think the name Outlaws is kind of a, you know, sexy thing to brandish. But, you know, when you take a look at what these people are and what they represent, the reason they're called the Outlaws is they basically have broken a lot of laws, and killing is just one of their means of staying, you know, in power.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, and to my understanding, the motorcycle gangs are some of the heaviest groups involved in human trafficking.
Absolutely. Absolutely. And, you know, they're involved in drug trafficking. You know, you look at, you're from Wisconsin, you look at the Harley-Davidson motorcycles. Hundreds and hundreds of these are stolen every year. And, you know, we know that the Outlaws are involved in this. And yet that trafficking of stolen motorcycle parts, we know that they go to Australia, to Germany. I mean, those motorcycle parts are worth thousands of dollars. And, you know, the whole history of the Outlaws and their love of Harley-Davidson motorcycles is an interesting chapter in the book.
Oh, well, I read the book that we mentioned briefly, We Have to Be Dirty, and I found it
right.
to be very, very educational. And I hope that the author writes more on the same subject, because he just touched the surface.
He did. And like I said, this is just Milwaukee. You know, we've kind of had that fascination because of Harley-Davidson motorcycles. But you go, you know, even to the, like I said, you go down south, you've got the Bandidos. You go, you know, to California, you've got the Hells Angels. And it's like that in most major cities. And, you know, these motorcycle gangs are predominantly white individuals involved with this. This is not, you know, like your Chicago gang activity, which is African American, but your motorcycle gangs are predominantly white males.
Yeah, without a doubt, I will say that the outlaw motorcycle groups are not your poster children for equal opportunity, positive racial relations.
That's very true. You know, you take a look at the KKK, and a lot of them, you know, are your basic motorcycle gang members.
Really? Okay. I did not know that. Interesting. I learned even more than I thought I would tonight already. It's amazing. Now, after the FBI cracked down on them severely, along with the ATF, are the outlaw motorcycle groups very active in the southeastern Wisconsin area anymore, or did they basically go away?
You know, they're around. They, you know, major police departments have always been able to handle these guys. So they've sort of, you know, germinated and gone out to the suburbs and to smaller areas of the country. But they're still here. And, you know, like I said, they kind of, a lot of their activity is now underground, stealing boats, stealing motorcycles, drug dealing. It's not like they're the, you know, the same people that would be, like I said, involved in these violent confrontations on the street with other motorcycle gangs anymore.
Huh. I mean, here in Racine, as I mentioned off air, we have an outlaw motorcycle club on Washington Avenue, right? The only thing that would that would tell that from any other building is when it says outlaw in front of the building front. And second, the street people who might be pandering and the penny ante drug dealers usually walk across the street. You know, they'll hang out in front. And that was always
right.
said to me as a newcomer we're seeing, it's because the outlaws are going to shoot them. I don't think that's necessarily the case. But I think that the mystique that the outlaw club still has and we're seeing might encourage people simply to move along.
Right. You know, and it does intimidate a lot of people. Like I said, you know, they recruit people. And there's a recruitment process that would make you know, going for the Navy SEALs look like joining the Girl Scouts. I mean, it's just unbelievable what they require their pledges to do, go out and commit crimes. And they wear leather vests that have to be urinated on by other members. And they've really got some interesting initiation type tactics to get those people into those motorcycle gangs.
Well, rest assured, I will not be joining that gang anytime soon.
I hope not.
Yeah, I think my wife would not approve of that, to say the least. But you've also done some work on television. Would you care to talk about that for a bit, sir?
Well, I do some work for a television show called Cold Justice. We used to be on TNT, and at the end of January, we were purchased by another network called Oxygen. But what we do is we take a look at cold cases. You know, and it's not the ones just where local law enforcement submits, you know, DNA from cases that were, you know, homicide cases from the late 90s all the way, you know, to the last few years. But we more or less look at circumstantial evidence along with some physical evidence, hopefully we have, and we try to link people now, basically just through different investigative methods. And, you know, it's funny, once these cases go cold, a lot of times we go back and talk to these people, and it's like, you know, a few years ago, this guy told me he did it, but I didn't believe him. And so they don't tell anything. I just can't believe how often when we go back and re-interview people that they have had information about these cases, and they just don't think it's worth talking to law enforcement about. I don't understand that at all. And those subsequently lead to, you know, we've been able to solve maybe 50% of the cases we went back and took and have taken a look at.
Wow. I know... I can only say that's living in Racine. It's unique. I live within a primarily Hispanic population, and I think we could have, well, God, we had some virtually like a pig next door, and nobody knew anything about it. You know,
right.
If we showed up asking questions, it was, well, we don't speak English. I'm sorry, we don't speak English. Then they brought a Spanish-speaking officer, and then everybody said, we didn't hear anything. And that might be the case, because
yep.
I live within 100 feet, and we didn't hear anything.
Yeah, that's true, too, you know, but, you know, intimate, you know, it used to be when we were taught homicides, when I go out and teach, nobody ever had anybody in their family or somebody you went to school with murdered, and now, I mean, you look at Chicago, everybody knows somebody who's been murdered within the last 10 years. It's just unbelievable. That's how violent we've gotten as a society, and a lot of those cases are difficult to solve up front if you've got gang members involved or even other family members involved. But, you know, as time goes on, relationships change between people. And sometimes people are willing then, you know, 4 or 5 years after a homicide to sit down and talk about it because I think they know that the family needs some type of closure or maybe they're not so afraid of this gang member anymore or they just finally have realized that it's the right thing to do to sit down and talk to law enforcement.
Right. You'd hope because, to me, if someone I care for greatly is injured or murdered, the more I can give law enforcement, the greater chance I'll have to be able to find justice for my loved one, right? I can understand people who know something but won't pick up the phone even to call Crime Stoppers anonymously and say, hey, I know that Jill was at that location at 10 o'clock last night. You know, that would be an easy thing to
right.
do. I don't understand why people don't.
Well, you know, you've got to understand, too, for the first time now, we're starting to see members, you know, witnesses actually intimidated and killed by other groups of people because here's what happens. If you're a witness, Wayne, to a homicide, your name is going to be given to the defense attorney, which is ultimately going to be given to the defendant. And they just
yep.
simply get other gang members to go out and intimidate you or your wife, and you're very reluctant to go out and testify. And I understand that. You know, you're going to send your kid to school or something in a community where somebody's got your name. And it's unfortunate, you know, you Google your name or something and pictures pop up or addresses pop up. It's not that hard to find people. And I understand, you know, when you're dealing with these gang members, how intimidating they can be.
Well, without a doubt. And thankfully, we don't have that problem in my area, Racine. But I suspect, I keep hearing that MS-13 is moving to Racine fast. And that's a rumor. Thankfully, it doesn't come true. Those would be people I wouldn't want nothing to do with because I don't think they play.
No, they don't. And then, you know, the problem's always been with the Hispanic gangs is they can flee back to Mexico. We don't have any type of jurisdiction to go down there and arrest them. And Mexico is very reluctant to ever extradite anybody back to the United States.
No, that's true. And when you read about, not to get political, but I have to mention this fact, and when you read the fact that when Mexican reporters report on crime in Mexico, trying to educate people what's going on, they're killed.
They've killed police chiefs down there, you know, for investigating. I mean, they cut their heads off and sent their heads in boxes to other officers. I mean, it's just unbelievable how violent they can be.
It's just amazing the level of violence, but we're also talking about there's an awful lot of money involved, and money in power will get people to do incredibly vicious things.
Absolutely.
And I'm sad to say, I'm sorry, I didn't mean to cut you off.
That's okay. Money has always been, you know, a huge problem. I mean, you know, you look at the drug transactions. I mean, when people are making hundreds of millions of dollars, you know, they're very, you know, they're just kind of, they've killed, you know, DEA agents, our U.S. DEA agents in Mexico. You know, it's just a ruthless operation. And you know, again, when you take a look here, back in the 80s, when I was even in Milwaukee, you could see what crack cocaine did to the inner city and how violent people became, and there was just drive-by shootings. And I've never seen as many shootings involved as there were with crack cocaine once it hit the streets.
Oh, it's horrific. I mean, the drug war is absolutely a horrible, horrible thing, and I think most Americans don't understand how the drug war started and what's ultimately behind it. And it's so easy to stick our heads in the sand because it brings up difficult questions that nobody, at least in my opinion, really wants to have an excavation about.
That's true.
Before we lose time, because I've seen the clock run down here, sir, where can we find you on social media?
You know, I basically, I've got a Facebook account. And I've also got a Twitter account. It's Milwaukee Spinny at Twitter.
Outstanding. And you're currently working on a book, correct?
I am. I'm working on one right now with somebody else. It's got to do with all the drownings. These young men have been found in rivers near colleges, and hopefully that will be out sometime in the middle of February.
I'm looking forward to that book. We had a conversation on Twitter, Twitter, Facebook, where we talked about that phenomena. And there's a lot of, I think, weird misinformation, but weird misinformation gets people listening to late-night radio shows.
It does. It does.
Where facts are more relevant. Like, I really appreciate you being able to talk about Jeffrey Dahmer with me.
Anytime.
Well, I'm going to call you again because I'd like to have a show with you talking about our situation we have with drugs from the law enforcement viewpoint, because I think you bring a lot of information to that conversation that most people don't think about.
Sure. Anytime you need anything, sir. Thank you very much.
Thank you, sir. I appreciate all your time again, sir. It's been an honor to talk to you. And again, have a great evening and do not try to freeze.
Thank you.
Yeah. All right. Thank you again, sir. Good night. Well, thank you so much for listening. I apologize for my voice acting weird tonight. As I said before, after my stroke, sometimes it strokes out. It kind of seizes up. It did this evening a little bit too, maybe because I'm a little bit nervous talking with this fine officer who lent me so much of his time to come on and talk about some things with his career in law enforcement. But appreciate everybody listening to the show. The best of you everywhere you might be. And remember, if you're in Wisconsin, it's cold out there. Take care of yourself and make sure you take care of your pets. Thanks again. Goodbye.